I'm Sat Chhabria, a member of the corporate team at Nishit Desai Associates, and today we're going to be discussing how to safeguard the interests of nominee directors in private equity investments needed due to the wide scope of Section 66 of the Insolvency and Bankruptcy Code, which basically contains the provisions relating to fraudulent and wrongful trading transactions. In the Indian market, there has been an increasing trend for private equity investors to get a nominee director on the board seat of the company they are investing in, along with another set of negotiated control and voting rights. While this does safeguard the investment, it also increases the risk incurred by the private equity investor if the company gets admitted to the corporate insolvency resolution process. For ease of reference, I shall be referring to this process as the CIRP. This is a recent phenomena and issue that has occurred due to the rationale of the Delhi High Court judgment in the beginning of the year in the case of Tata Steel BSL Limited versus Venus Recruiter Private Limited and others. I'll be calling this the Tata Steel judgment. In this judgment, the Delhi High Court has held that an application for avoidance of a preferential transaction can be heard and adjudicated by the National Law Company Tribunal even after the approval of a resolution plan. This judgment overrules the previous position of law and understanding that the CIRP normally ends with the approval of a resolution plan. It was important to point out this judgment and the externalities that it may have, especially as it may be adverse for investors, not just because it expands the already broad scope of the creditor beneficial legislation under the IBC, but it also puts at risk the investor's investment corpus and assets in case of personal liability which may be imposed on them by virtue of the actions or inactions of the nominee directors. Therefore, this podcast would aim to highlight the risk to the investors due to the wide scope of Section 66 of the code and point out possible safeguards that may be taken to counter this. To begin, we will first explain the types of avoidable transactions that are there to establish the context of this and especially focus on the fraudulent and wrongful trading transactions. Under the IBC, given that it's possible that the management of a corporate debtor before the initiation of the CIRP undertakes transactions which could have adversely impacted the financial interest of its stakeholders, therefore the code encapsulates a regime which provides a method to nullify such transactions and render them ineffective, along with any asset transfer that may have been done pursuant to such transaction, keeping in mind the larger interest of the creditors. There are four such types of avoidable transactions, namely preferential transactions, undervalued transactions, fraudulent transactions, and extortionate transactions, which are covered under Chapter 3 and 6 of the Code. The Supreme Court, in the case of Anuj Jain Interim Resolution Professional for JP versus Axis Bank, has laid out conditions to be satisfied in order for a transaction to be classified into one of these four aforementioned categories, basically PUFE transactions. The focus of this podcast is on the fraudulent and wrongful trading transactions, as these pose a higher degree of risk to the investor nominee directors upon initiation of CIRP or liquidation proceedings due to several factors. Some of these factors which contribute to this higher risk is the very wide scope and broad wordings of Section 66 of the Code. The fact that this section imposes personal liability on even non-executive directors. There is no look-back period under this code for fraudulent transactions, while look-back period basically is the relevant time up to which a resolutional profession can go back to scrutinize an expected avoidable transaction. Further, this section imposes liability on a nominee director retrospectively, even after the investor has exited. And the impact of the Tata Steel judgment is extremely integral because it means that the management of a debtor would continue to be liable for fraudulent transactions even after the creditor has received payments under a resolution plan and acquisition of the debtor. Let's discuss the first factor, which is the broad scope of this provision of law. It is divided into two, Section 66(1) and Section 66 subclause 2. The first part of Section 66 talks about fraud and lays down the standard for fraudulent transactions, wherein it apportions liability on any person to make contribution to the assets of the debtor if he has carried on the business knowingly or for a fraudulent purpose. Now, the way the 66.1 is worded is extremely broad. As you can see through the usage of words like any person, the definition of person within the code has an unrestricted scope, and it's not restricted to insiders only, such as the promoters, employees or executive directors, but it also extends to any person, including other companies, creditors or individuals who are knowingly parties to that fraudulent transaction. Individuals are not the only ones covered, but also corporates, and accordingly there's a possibility that the adjudicating authority may hold a corporate investor liable in certain circumstances. For example, if there's a fraud and if the authority is able to establish intention on the part of the investor to the effect that the nominee director is just a representative and is not acting on his own volition, then the authority may pierce the corporate veil and hold the corporate investor liable. While there is no existing jurisprudence where the authority has held a corporate entity behind the nominee director liable, this is a possible interpretation in view of this broad definition. Further, the code does not define the term knowingly. Mere knowledge could be deemed sufficient for the purpose without requiring any active participation in the act. With the wording and the requirement to establish dishonest intention, the problem of evidence arises. In the case of Grantham versus R, it was held that it is not necessary that the person accused must believe there is no reasonable prospect of ever paying the creditor, but it is sufficient to show that he believed the debt could not be paid when it became due or shortly thereafter. Further, there is a lack of look-back period as explained earlier. The directors have been held liable in the past for their actions which fell within the look-back period. This is happening in all other types of transactions, but there's a conspicuous lack of a look-back period only with respect to fraudulent transaction, which essentially means that a resolution professional can go back any number of years to check for fraudulent transactions and hold a director liable even after resignations for these actions, going back several years. Now, going to the second part of Section 66, which talks about wrongful trading. This 66.2 imposes liability only on the director and partner of a company as opposed to 66.1. And it can impose this liability only when this director or partner falls short of the specific fiduciary duty that he owes towards the company and the duty of care he owes towards the stakeholders, including the creditors. There's no requirement to establish wrongful intention. So long as it's proven that the director has acted negligently or recklessly, thereby exposing the company to risk. The impugned director in such cases cannot even plead ignorance or lack of knowledge. Under this Section 66.2, the standard for deeming an action as wrongful trading has to be established by the authority on a case-by-case basis, using a yardstick of whether the director had exercised general knowledge, skill and experience to be expected of a person carrying out the same functions. The courts have ruled that if the director shuts his eyes to what must be obvious to someone, even superfluously, he could be held liable for dereliction of duties and be compelled to make good the losses caused to the company due to his neglect, even if he has not been held guilty for the commission of fraud. There's also an additional duty which the directors have to do, and they have to take active steps in terms of conducting due diligence during the period when they ought to have known that the commencement of CIRP was imminent for the company, based on a reasonable man standard, till the time the company enters into such resolution. This interim period is known as the twilight zone, and upon entering this zone, the intentions and actions of the directors need to shift from maximizing the interest of the shareholders to protecting the interest of the creditors in order for the director to avoid this liability. So this shift needs to be shown. In view of the above, it's pertinent to note that the tribunal has given inter alia the following indicative examples of wrongful trading. Either repaying a loan received from a director while other creditors were not paid, a director paying his own salary while the salary for the employees was not paid, buying goods on credit when there's no means to pay for them, using customer deposits for cash flow purposes with no means of supplying goods, not keeping proper accounting records, or any transfer or sale of assets at anything less than a fair and reasonable commercial value. We can see that the scope is extremely broad, and the question now is, will nominee directors fall within this scope? In the past, the people responsible for management of a company have always been held liable for any fraudulent actions perpetrated by the corporate entity. However, it has been open for directors to seek exemptions from liabilities by stating that they are non-executive or independent directors who are not responsible for the day-to-day affairs of the company. Further, a claimant would have to provide strong evidence of malafide intention and establish a causal nexus between the fraud and the involvement of the director in order to pierce the corporate veil and make a director personally liable for these fraudulent transactions. The development of jurisprudence around Section 66 of the Code substantiates a lower threshold to pierce this corporate veil and the unlimited liability that ensues on nominee directors. Section 66 is seen as a radical extension in civil liabilities for directors whose fraudulent, reckless, and negligent actions during financial distress affect the interest of creditors, made all the more potent because of its broad scope and low thresholds. Private equity investors often choose to have a nominee director on the board of directors of the investee company. If the investee company has conducted a transaction post the investment, for example, transferring a business vertical to a group entity at a subdued valuation prior to initiation of the CIRP, then the resolution professional might flag off such a transaction as fraudulent, subject to adjudication by the authority. The rights given to the investor under the investment documents, such as the rights to a board seat, observer, quorum rights, affirmative voting rights, information and inspection rights, are all intended to ensure that the nominee director, and by extension the investor, had knowledge of the affairs of the company. If intention is proved by virtue of the scope, any person, the investor, may also be held liable. If not, with the mere possession of information and exercise of control that has been granted to the investor under the investment documents, the nominee director may be held liable for not exercising sufficient due diligence as expected from one in his position. Therefore, what are the potential safeguards that the investor can keep in mind before entering into a transaction? The first is having a director's and officer's insurance policy in place. This will ensure if the nominee director is held liable because of a fault of the debtor, he will be covered by the insurance paid by the debtor. However, this will not be applicable in cases of fraud. Secondly, is to have a very robust indemnity clause. Most investment documents have a clause distinguishing between the nominee directors and executive directors of the company, thus specifically insulating the nominee directors from any liability that may arise out of the day-to-day functioning of the company. Investors should consider incorporating a specific provision to the effect that if an order is passed under the code against the nominee director, the losses incurred as a result of this order should be indemnified by the debtor to the investor. Finally, the investor also will need to carefully balance the potential risk that could arise out of this Section 66 with the kind of operational control they are seeking to achieve in the company. The more robust the set of investor rights in relation to information, inspectors, affirmative voting rights, etc., the more risk they will incur. These clauses need to be carefully drafted, keeping in mind minimum level of intervention at the operational level by the investor. For example, if the information rights are very exhaustive and also include a catch-all clause of providing all information requested by the investor, it's very easy for the authority to establish presence of knowledge on the part of the investor and hence attract liability under Section 66. Over the course of the last 6 years, we've seen multiple examples where huge corporate entities have been sent for insolvency resolution without there being much realizable value for the creditors. We have also witnessed mega corporate financial scandals involving the board of directors. For example, the scandals involving DHFL, HDIL, Yes Bank, Videocon, ICICI Bank, to name just a few. The broad scope of the provisions of law pertaining to fraudulent transactions and wrongful trading, as well as the adjudication of standards by the authority on a case-to-case basis, has led to a perilous pit for non-executive nominee directors, and in turn the investors, who need to keep this in mind and tread carefully on the track. Thank you.